your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Variety is pretty hard to find on today's airwaves. How about joining the cause to promote alternative variety? TCM 189 is the staff training course for HFCC's own WHFR, a station devoted to new, local, and unique artists. The course provides students with essential station procedures as well as equipment knowledge and basic performance skills. The class can be taken for credit or under the Center for Lifelong Learning. For more information, contact Susan McGraw, WHFR's general manager at 313-845-9842.
Mountain Stage, the internationally distributed weekly two-hour live performance program out of West Virginia and hosted by Larry Gross, has made the move to Wednesdays 6 to 8 p.m. Tune in for live folk, blues, bluegrass, and more right here on WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Again, that's Mountain Stage on its new night and time, Wednesdays 6 to 8, here on WHFR.FM.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Host Analytics, a provider of cloud corporate performance management and business analytics, offering products working to impact financial decisions for over a decade. More information at hostanalytics.com/NPR.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Rizdahl.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, it is so good to talk to you again, man.
And to you, Kai. I missed you, too. How's your summer been?
Good. Busy, but good.
Good. Tis, of course, the season for outdoor activity, some of which I'm here to tell you can have a very significant downside.
What, like sunburn and mosquito? But what?
No, I'm actually talking about death. So I hate to be a killjoy in the middle of summer.
Okay.
But I thought it might be worthwhile to look at the relative danger of some of America's favorite summertime activities.
All right.
Okay, so let's start with motorcycling. Here's Randa Samaha from the National Crash Analysis Center.
Okay.
Motorcyclists are very vulnerable road users. For every 100 million vehicle mile travel, there are over 24 riders killed.
So when I was 20-something years old, I told my grandfather that I wanted to buy a motorcycle, and he said, I would sooner kill you with my bare hands. He was a doctor.
Good advice. Yeah. Okay. I don't know if you own a boat, Kai,
but the
boating statistics are a little bit frightening. Here's Mike Barron with the U.S. Coast Guard.
We're roughly down to about, say 6.2 deaths per every 100,000 boats.
And swimming, something most of us do. I do a lot of that in the summer. Here's Julie Gilchrist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Overall, the drowning rate in the United States for all ages is 1.29 per 100,000.
Huh.
And I couldn't find any stats on golfing deaths. That's what I spend, my free time. I think that's relatively safe. But skydiving, here's Nancy Corrine from the U.S. Parachute Association.
Wow. There's been an average of maybe 22 fatalities a year. Which is about 7 per 1 million skydives.
Okay, wait. So 7 per million versus all those others, which is not so many. No, not so bad, right?
So, you know, the motorcycle death rate is based on the number of miles traveled. Swimming deaths, meanwhile, are counted on a per capita basis. Skydiving deaths based on the number of jumps. And, of course, a lot fewer people go skydiving every year than go swimming.
Help me out here, though, Freakonomics Obi-Wan. What is the message here? I know what it is. We're scared of the wrong thing.
That is exactly right. Human beings are generally quite bad at assessing risk. We tend to get worried about the big anomalous events, shark attacks, for instance, which on average kill fewer. Well, they are scary and they get a lot of news coverage. And then when they get a lot of news coverage, we're convinced that they're a lot more common than they are. 5 people on average worldwide die from unprovoked shark attacks. Meanwhile, in the U.S. alone, in a given year, 4,500 people die from motorcycle accidents and another 4,000 or so from drowning.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I could step off the curb in front of Marketplace Global Headquarters here this afternoon on my way to get a
God
cup of coffee.
God forbid, but yes, you could.
And I could be hit by a bus. I mean, what am I supposed to do?
Well, you're going to do what you want to
yes,
do.
Yes, I am. Uh-huh.
And I'm not saying you should be overly scared of things you shouldn't be, but there is a lot to learn at looking at these numbers, just taking a step back and doing it. One piece of data that really jumps out at you is this, the ability of alcohol to help make bad things happen. Okay, so listen to this. About 30% of all motorcyclists who died were legally drunk. The Coast Guard tells us that alcohol was the primary contributing factor in about 16% of the boating fatalities.
Mm. What about skydiving? I mean, people don't drink and skydive, do they?
You know, there are no hard and fast stats on it. We did ask, here's Nancy Kareen again from the Parachute Association.
For the most part, skydivers aren't really interested in doing that kind of thing. Skydiving is fun enough. You're having a good time and, you know, why would you add that extra element of risk?
You know, Kai, this raises an interesting point. If an activity is prima facie dangerous, maybe it scares people away from adding a layer of danger by drinking, you know?
Hang on a minute, right? Because motorcycling is prima facie, although I always thought it was prima facie, but it's prima facie dangerous, but people drink and motorcycle all the time.
Well, to some people it is, and to some people plainly it's not. I mean, I tend to agree with you, especially riding bike without a helmet. You know, helmets are estimated to prevent about 40% of crash deaths among motorcyclists, and yet there are a lot of bikers out there who would much prefer to ride a bike than to not, and to ride a bike without a helmet. Look, if safety is your number one concern this summer, I'm not saying it should be, but if it is, I've got the ultimate activity for you and everybody.
All right, what's up?
There.
Hit me with it.
You stay inside, you listen to your radio.
Stephen Dubner.
Taking the coward's way out,
That's right. Hey, man, I'm all right with that.
Hey, podcast listeners, coming up on next week's podcast, the second half of our two-part episode, Freakonomics Goes to College. The central question, is a college degree really worth all that money and effort? And I asked Steve Levitt about the magic that happens in the college classroom.
So obviously, I teach my students. I teach them very specific things. But I know that when I talk to them years later, they don't remember anything that I taught them. I mean, I can ask them the most simple questions about the material we covered, and they have no recollection whatsoever, the typical students.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Host Analytics, a provider of cloud corporate performance management and business analytics, offering products working to impact financial decisions for over a decade. More information at hostanalytics.com/NPR.
Hello, Mr. Azell?
Yes.
Hi, Stephen Dubner. Nice to meet you.
Stephen, nice to meet you. And you won't believe what I'm holding in my hand.
Let me guess, because I just got a degree in psychic work, so I'm going to say...
I'm impressed. Over the internet?
Of course. Where else? I'm going to say that you have in your hand a diploma, maybe from Appalachian State University?
Yes, founded in the year 1899. And I like their logo down at the bottom.
Uh-huh. And what did I get my degree in?
Oh, I have no idea. This is a blank.
Oh, so it can be whatever I...
Sure.
You know, I've always wanted to be a vet.
Well, if that turns you on, then that's fine. And I'm sure that the animals would have fun with your children.
And do you maybe also have a graduate degree from Columbia University as well?
The trustees of Columbia University and the city of New York, to all persons to whom these represents may come greeting, be it known that, having completed the studies and satisfied the requirements for the degree of... And it's a blank also.
Ah, hot diggity. You know, because I did get a degree in writing there, but I really thought I should have become a doctor instead. So,
hey, you can be whatever you want to be. Remember, I've got two MDs.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
On today's show, we're talking about the value of a college degree. Now, for the record, I really did go to college. I got my undergraduate degree in broadcast journalism, actually, at Appalachian State University, and I got an MFA in writing from Columbia, which is why Alan Ezell brought those particular diplomas to the radio studio. Now, you may be asking, who is Alan Ezell, and how did he get hold of these blank diplomas? Well, he used to work for the FBI.
I retired in late 1991, and for 12 years, I handled what was called Operation Dip Scam, Diploma Scam, and it was a series of investigations on degree mills, diploma mills, throughout the United States and some were abroad.
Now, it should be said, you say that you handled this investigation, but you're being a little modest here. You created this investigation, didn't you?
Well, that's true, too.
Here's how it started. One day in 1980, an informant came into Ezell's FBI office in Charlotte, North Carolina, and laid a couple of fake college diplomas on his desk. He told Ezell about a man in Greenville, South Carolina, who was selling them. So Ezell made a phone call. He didn't say he was with the FBI. He said he was an accountant, hoping to get a promotion. That first day when you got on the phone with the president of the university in Greenville, South Carolina, what was the name of that university?
Southeastern.
Southeastern. And was it a real college at all?
That word, real. Yes, it was. Well, it's a relative term.
Yeah.
There was a point in time, probably 11 years before that, that it did have a building. There later came a point in time when it, and they had a fire or something, when it stopped being real in that sense. And then the proprietor started operating the school out of three rooms of his house.
What was this fellow's name?
Dr. Alfred Jarrett.
Okay, so you called him up that day. You called up Dr. Jarrett at Southeastern University. And what did you say to him?
We negotiated the price for my bachelor's, master's, and doctorate with no work whatsoever.
Wait, you bought a bachelor's, master's, and a doctorate all at once?
Sure, triple combo, have it backdated, you know, with transcript.
During that conversation, Ezell made it sound as if he and a colleague might be helpful to Jarrett in growing his diploma business. So Jarrett invited them for a visit.
He took us on a tour of his house and the three rooms involved. He showed us the school filing cabinet.
Yeah.
He showed us our student files and the other student files. He showed us blank diplomas, transcripts, seals, ribbons, all the trappings that it would take. Now, all of this information we use in our affidavit for the federal search warrant.
Ezell and some other FBI agents put together their case and then went back to see Jarrett, this time with a search warrant.
I tried to explain to him that life is not over, that this is just a search warrant. So we spent 2 or 3 hours there. We did what we were supposed to. And then we left town and went back to Charlotte. But we later learned the following day when the phone rang that after we had gone, Dr. Jarrett went out with a lady friend of his for dinner, started giving away some of his possessions, and then went into the bathroom and took a .38 and put it up to his head and committed suicide. We did not see that coming. I did not see that coming at all. We had not even read all the boxes of stuff that we had. When we did read it, we saw that he had approximately 600-plus graduates over 11 years. We had federal, state, and county employees. We had law enforcement. You name the profession, we had it.
And that was Alan Ezell's introduction to the world of fake diplomas. Over the next decade, he helped uncover a huge counterfeit market, companies all over the country doing millions of dollars worth of business.
We bought 40 degrees. We had 16 federal search warrants, 19 federal grand jury indictments, about 21 convictions. We dismantled 40 schools and/or counterfeit operations. The highest gross revenue that I saw then, and this is pre-internet, was $2 million. Now, after the internet came about, $2 million that I was seeing for a gross revenue is not even pocket change. We're now seeing $36 million, $7 million, $5 million, and the Lollapalooza, the biggest one that we have ever seen, called University Degree Program, and they operated from 98 through about 03. By our calculations, they grossed $453 million, and the paper that they sold will pollute the market for years to come. And what makes it even worse, they sold degrees in anesthesiology, cardiology, dermatology, endocrinology, gastroenterology, neurology, obstetrics, oncology, ophthalmology, pediatrics, psychiatry, radiology, surgery, urology. And I would ask you, where do you think the people are employed that bought degrees in those majors?
Well, that's what I want to know, Alan, because if you're saying this one firm grossed 450-some million dollars over, what, a five-year period, the average price, let's say, was $1,000, let's say.
No, it was more. It was about $2,400, and you had a $500 discount. So let's go in at $2,000.
Even so, that's more than 200,000 totally fake degrees.
I told you they were the Lollapalooza.
And that's one firm. So yeah. I have two questions for you. One is, where the hell are all these fake doctors and how do I stay away from them? And two is, if there are 200,000 roughly from one firm, how many fakes are we talking about in toto?
We have no idea. Let me put it this way. The United States, all the colleges and universities in our country, award about 1.3 million degrees a year. Approximately 1% of that, we believe, is the amount of phony degrees that are sold in our country each year. As to where these people are that bought those degrees, we don't have a clue. And I say that because no one in law enforcement, federal law enforcement, chased them. We don't know who they are. We don't know where they're employed. Only occasionally will a graduate flush up. He could be practicing in a hospital. He could have something go awry in a medical procedure, and then they start looking at his credentials and then find out he's a phony. You would be shocked at the number of people that buy this garbage and then put it on their resume and then post this online.
When Ezell retired in 1991, Operation Dip Scam ended. And, he says, the FBI pretty much stopped investigating fake degrees. The industry has exploded since then. And today, you can buy just about any kind of degree online.
There are two basic kinds of operations. One is simply a counterfeiting company, which sells fake versions of real degrees from the university of your choice. The other is a diploma mill, essentially a fake university that issues its own degree, like Southeastern University and Dr. Jarrett. Sometimes a diploma mill will ask you for a resume and award course credits based on your work history. Occasionally, you'll have to do some actual work.
I mean, the most I've ever done is 5 pages on a master's, okay?
But a lot of the time, you just pay the fee.
Smash and grab. Here's my check. Give me my degree.
So imagine you've got a low-level job and you want a promotion that requires additional schooling, but you don't want to go back to school. So you tell your boss you're working on a degree at night, and then a year or two later, you give your boss your new fake diploma. Hey, thanks, Diploma Mill.
As of today, there's no federal criminal legislation regarding using diploma mill paper in this regard.
You sound as though you're not happy that there is no law against that.
Oh, no, I've never been happy. The way you get somebody's attention is with some handcuffs, okay? The threat of a civil fine or embarrassment will not do it. We need a federal law that forbids the diploma mills, non-accredited institutions, institutions that don't have regional or national acceptable accreditation. It should not be this easy.
Does it still burn you after all these years of pursuing these guys to know that people are cheating so baldly?
Oh, it always has. I mean, I have two daughters, one that graduated from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, one that graduated from the University of Florida. I have bought counterfeits of both of their school diplomas with transcripts. And I probably paid less than $800 for both. And you can imagine the thousands of dollars to send them to school. No, I cannot take away their level of learning that they had by going to school. But by buying a counterfeit, I can devalue the piece of paper that they walked out with at the end. Because it undermines all of our legitimate education. Every one of us that have spent time, money, effort, sweat, all-nighters, it devalues the degrees that we have.
If Azell's ballpark guess is true, that roughly 1% of college degrees are fake, just think about that. If you work in government or healthcare or maybe in public radio, for every 100 coworkers, one of them is a fraud. You've got to wonder if there's something about how we look at real college degrees that makes a fake one so attractive and so easy to get.
You can be whatever you want to be.
You can be whatever you want to be. We say that a lot, parents to kids especially. But what we really mean is you can be whatever you want to be, but first, you need a college degree. Now, degree mills exploit our collective college anxiety, and they tell people, don't worry about the education. It's the piece of paper that gets you the job. Plus, a real degree is expensive. Not only the money itself, but 4 years of your life. And especially when the economy is crummy as it is now, it's unclear if that investment is paying off. Coming up, we'll talk about how much a college degree matters when you work in the White House.
I think I was in the last generation that could be stupid enough not to get a college degree.
This podcast of Freakonomics Radio is supported by Host Analytics, a provider of cloud financial management and business analytics technology. Host Analytics has been helping to drive business decisions for over a decade by streamlining customers' budgeting, planning, and financial reporting processes with little or no IT overhead. More information and access to the results of a finance executive survey at hostanalytics.com/NPR.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Here's the thing. When you look around at a variety of fields, you can find some really, really successful people who did not finish college. And not just in sports and entertainment. I'm talking about people at the top of knowledge fields where smarts are key. So Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Richard Branson. Even in politics, you can find a few.
Hey, Stephen, how are you?
That's Karl Rove, former senior advisor and deputy chief of staff for President George W. Bush. Rove is currently a commentator for Fox News and a contributor to the Wall Street Journal. And at first glance, Rove's academic credentials seem to be commensurate with his achievement. So here's what I read from your bio, that you were a Colorado native who attended the University of Utah, the University of Maryland, College Park, George Mason University, and the University of Texas at Austin. But what I can't tell from that is if you actually graduated college. So tell me if you did or not.
No, I never did. Otherwise, I'd say I was a graduate of one of those colleges.
So I'm curious to the degree to which you were leaving college because you were working. It wasn't you were leaving college to eat Cheetos on the couch, right?
Well, yeah, no. I left college because I had a greater economic opportunity. I mean, I went to the University of Utah. Only was able to attend college because I had a $1,500 a year scholarship from the William Randolph Hearst Foundation, and I had to, you know, wait tables and run a cash register in a hippie shop that sold patchouli oil and work in an industrial kitchen at a hospital in order to make ends meet. And even then, I didn't have very many ends. But, you know, I left the University of Utah, where I'd been for 2 years, in order to accept a job at the Republican National Committee. At the height of the Vietnam War, went to the University of Maryland, lost my student deferment, was almost drafted, went to the George Mason in order to keep trying to get to the college degree, and the same at the University of Texas. And, you know, I was cobbling together courses here and there, but each time the chance to get the college degree was stymied by, you know, having sort of an unusual opportunity.
In each case, in each of these universities when you were enrolled, were you a political science major?
Yes. Probably the most useless degree that one can seek, but I'm sort of stuck.
Rove is widely considered to be a political genius. He was the architect of President Bush's two electoral campaigns, and he had a lot of policy influence in the White House. And he's a guy who left college because it just wasn't worth it to him. He found he could learn more in the field than in a classroom. Listening to him, you start to think, if you can learn so much by doing, why bother getting a degree?
But mine's an atypical experience. I mean, I think I was in the last generation that could be stupid enough not to get a college degree. I think we live in a society in which credentials matter. I mean, the Bill Gates of the world who go on to found Microsoft after dropping out of Harvard are few and far between. The Karl Roves who go on to be, you know, senior advisor to the president after, you know, never completing your degree are few and far between.
Rove points out that he did learn a lot in college, but not the kind of things you might expect.
The best course I ever took in college was in my sophomore year, and it was a course in Shakespearean literature. I learned more about political communications in that one semester from a Catholic nun than I learned in any political science course. It made me aware of the power of language and how telling a story, a political campaign is about big issues, but you have to describe a narrative. You have to create a storyline. You know, what is this all about?
So as of today, how close are you to getting your undergraduate degree? How many credit hours shy are you?
I think I'm my language requirement and about, I think about 6 hours or 9 hours beyond that. Math course, science course, and language is what I think. Now, the language is going to kill me.
And realistically, how old are you now, Carl?
61.
And realistically, you think you're ever going to get your college degree?
Let's keep it out there as a goal. You know, life is about, you know, upward vision, about moving towards the ever higher plateaus and mountain peaks. So let's keep it out there.
We don't really know why different people choose different levels of education.
That's David Card. He's an economist at the University of California, Berkeley.
Some people think it's all parental background. Some people think it's other attributes.
If you ask an economist like David Card a simple question about college, like, is it worth it? He'll tend to focus on the most tangible outcome, what economists call the returns to education, which pretty much boils down to how much more money you'll make if you go to college.
In my family, we have all five possible levels of education. We have somebody who didn't finish high school, someone who just finished high school, somebody who has kind of a 3 years of college, vocational college, somebody who has a bachelor's degree with a teaching certificate, and then me who has a PhD. And if you just were to look at our family every step of the way, the returns to education are enormous. I mean, totally enormous.
So the one who did not finish high school does what for a living?
Basically cleans houses.
Uh-huh, yeah. And is the level of educational attainment kind of a conversation in the family, or is it something that is just known, acknowledged, and, you know, that's the way it is?
Well, I think like many families, the next generations, people say, well, should we try and convince this kid to go to college or not?
Yeah.
And you know, it's easy to say, well, look, if you go to college, you're going to have a little bit easier choices to make.
Yeah.
Once you get through that, things are going to be a lot easier for you. If you don't have – going forward, I think anybody who has kids who can possibly make it through a bachelor's degree should really think of some way to get them through.
Yeah.
Because I don't see much of a future 20 years from now for the kid who doesn't have that.
It's always tempting to cast about for the anomalies, the billionaire who dropped out of college, or on the other hand, the PhD who's driving a taxi. But let's not get distracted by the anomalies. If you want to measure the value of education, you have to think in the aggregate, and that's what economists like to do. Here's my Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt, an economist at the University of Chicago.
The best way I think an economist thinks about the value of education is tries to figure out how the market rewards it and what other benefits come with. And one thing is clear, is that the market puts a tremendous reward on education. So the best estimates that economists have are that each extra year of education that you get is worth about maybe an 8% increment to your earnings each year for the rest of your life. So it turns out for most people, buying a lot of education is, or at least for the average person, let me say, buying a lot of education is a really good deal.
And here's David Card again.
In addition to that, the one who went to college will probably work 4 or 5 years longer at the end of their life. They'll probably have less months of unemployment. They'll probably have longer hours of work while they're working. So all in all, their total earnings will be even higher than their kind of standard wage.
I mean, we're talking about economically, at least, we're talking about black and white. That's over the course
massive
of a lifetime,
returns.
Massive, massive.
Yeah, yeah.
How does this shake out historically? In other words, was this advantage, what did that advantage look like 20 years ago, 30 years ago? Do we know?
It looks like where we are today is as high as it's ever been in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
The low point was about 1975 to 80. Actually, when I graduated college. And ironically, a very well-known labor economist, a friend of mine, Richard Freeman, wrote a book in the late 70s called The Overeducated American, in which he argued that trends were suggesting that too many people were going to college.
Yeah.
Now, if anybody had followed that advice, it would have been the worst possible choice they would have could have made, because starting around 1978, 79, the return has just marched up steadily.
But what about now? I mean, we've had a few years of pretty crappy economy employment-wise. Is it time to start thinking about the overeducated American problem?
I would say the returns are even higher now than because of the recession, that people aren't thinking about it right. So they notice that somebody who graduates from college is having a bit of a hard time getting a job, or they notice that the unemployment rate for college grads has gone up a little bit. But if you do the right counterfactual and say, well, what if I didn't have the college degree? It's much worse. The rise in unemployment was much higher for people with just a high school diploma. As has always been true in every recession, the recession is always worse for less educated people.
So is it safe to say then that returns to college education in the United States are historically at a high?
Yes.
Okay. So if that's the case, I guess that's great news for colleges. It's great news for college professors like yourself. It's great news for people who plan to go to college.
Well, There is a problem. That's the kind of the benefit side of the calculation.
Yeah.
And we haven't really talked about the cost.
Ah, yes. The cost. As former FBI man Alan Ezel told us, you can get a fake diploma for a few hundred dollars, but the real deal? Much, much more expensive. On our next episode, we'll try to figure out why does college cost so much?
I went to Wellesley College. I think it's a great place. And I saw the other day their tuition for the incoming class and almost spit out my drink.
And what exactly happens in the college classroom to give graduates such an advantage later in life?
I teach my students. I teach them very specific things. But I know that when I talk to them years later, they don't remember anything that I taught them. I mean, I can ask them the most simple questions about the material we covered, and they have no recollection whatsoever, the typical students.
That's all coming up next time on Freakonomics Goes to College, Part 2. Yeah, come on in. Hey, Catherine.
Hey, can I come in for a second?
Sure, what did we do wrong? This is Catherine Wells, everybody. She produced this program.
Sorry to interrupt here, but this has just made me wonder. I'm curious. Is there anything you wish you could do, but you just don't have the education for it?
I'd like to do surgery, just casually. So,
right.
But I don't
casual surgery.
Yeah, but I don't really have the appetite to get that much education. But there, no, I'd like to be able to, you know, operate on people, and
right.
animals. But
I was thinking because when you talked to Alan Ezel, you said you know you'd always wanted to be a vet.
Yeah, a vet. Yeah.
And so the radio staff and I were thinking,
no.
and we don't want you to be held back anymore. so we have a little present for you here.
This is too good to be true. So it's a brown envelope, mailing envelope that says "Congrats," handwritten, not an official stamp, no wax seal. Appalachian State University, the Board of Regents for the University, upon the recommendation of the faculty, has conferred on Stephen J. Dubner the degree of Doctor of Philosophy in Animal Health. Oh, summa
congratulations.
Cum laude. Oh, my God. Thank you so much. This, to my untrained eye, looks like a legit diploma. Looks
yeah,
real.
Yeah, it's very professional.
Where'd you get it?
Online. Uh-huh. The company, I think, was called diplomamakers.com.
Nice, diplomamakers.com.
$190, uh-huh. any degree you want.
Now that I think about it, I don't think I'm one of those people that have my diplomas uh-huh. hanging on a wall somewhere. I have no idea where my diplomas are. But my PhD,
frame that one.
My PhD in animal health is definitely going on the wall. Thank you very much.
Anyway, congratulations.
It's very thoughtful.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. This episode was produced by Catherine Wells. Our staff includes Susie Lechtenberg, David Herman, Beret Lamb, and Chris Bannon. Jake Smith is our intern. Colin Campbell is our executive producer. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or go to
Earth, Sky.
People are just a little bit more aware, or a lot more aware now, of the economic impact and the societal impact of large and sustained volcanic eruptions. It's a natural phenomenon. It's not going to go away. It's going to happen. And as we inhabit more and more of the airspace and of the ground, land space, and really the coastal areas, it's going to affect us.
You're listening to research scientist David Pieri of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Dr. Pieri's job is to help keep air travel safe. He does that with an instrument called ASTER on NASA's Terra satellite to track the aftermath of volcanic eruptions, plumes of ash that shoot high into the stratosphere. Pieri spoke more about keeping planes safe by watching volcanoes from space with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Dr. Pieri, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
Well, thank you, Jorge. I appreciate that.
So why study volcanoes from space?
Well, gosh, you know, that would be an hour show in itself, just talking about that. But But I'll give you the short version. I mean, volcanoes have been a threat to humanity since people have begun to walk the Earth. And, you know, you can think back to the classic eruption of Pompeii and you know, ash and hot rock and all kinds of noxious, terrible, toxic gases coming out of the Earth. And these things happen still with about the same frequency, and they can be very big, like a Pinatubo eruption, which can put ash up into the stratosphere and have global effects affecting air traffic and, of course, affecting air quality and the environment locally around the volcano. So these are big, dangerous features that manifest the internal energy of the Earth at the surface. And so we want to know about them. Now, the mission that I'm on, called ASTER, which is Advanced Spaceborne Thermal Emission and Reflection Radiometer, a real mouthful, joint with the Japanese, we look at things down to 15 meters across. So we have a number of tools from orbit. We can look at these big eruptions, and the real important thing is to be able to detect them, the fact that they happen, especially in remote areas, and then also to monitor them and to understand how much material they're putting in the atmosphere. And that's all important because of the things I mentioned, and particularly these days, particularly airline traffic and other kinds of air traffic up at 30,000 feet are very severely affected by ash.
How does NASA's Terra satellite see what volcanoes are doing on the ground, on Earth, and what is NASA looking for with these satellites?
Well, we have several dozen volcanologists who use the data who are experienced in remote sensing as well as volcanology. I guess I could say I'm one of them. We take data at visible wavelengths, much like you would see with your own eyes, and then we have infrared capability as well, both in the short wavelength infrared and the longer wavelength infrared. Now, the long wavelength infrared is basically heat radiation coming up from the surface of the Earth. So the infrared capability with ASTER allows us to map these features in detail. Now, ASTER looks at the Earth at 15 meters per picture element. That is the smallest thing that can be resolved in the picture, is a picture element. So we can resolve, for instance, the summit craters of volcanoes. We can resolve individual lava flows. We can resolve areas where vegetation has been destroyed. We can look at areas of devastation. Now, the other instrument on, one of the other instruments on Terra is the moderate resolution imaging spectrometer. It has many more bands than ASTER, and it looks through visible near-infrared and the thermal infrared as well, but at much lower spatial resolution. However, you get a synoptic view or an overall view of thousands of kilometers, where ASTER can only see a postage stamp that's 60 by 60 kilometers across. MODIS can look at areas thousands of kilometers across, and it looks at the whole Earth every day.
Dr. Pieri, would you explain to us, why are volcanoes dangerous to airplanes which fly way above at 30,000 feet?
Well, when we really get concerned is when we have a large explosive eruption. That material gets up in the air and the atmospheric winds take it, particularly in the stratosphere. The ash will settle down to about 10,000 meters or so. And unfortunately, that's the most efficient operating altitude for aircraft. And, of course, if you're unlucky enough to actually penetrate a plume, and that's happened many times and three times with 747 aircraft, where we've actually had simultaneous all-engine failures, that is, four engines failed simultaneously. The Redoubt eruption in 1989 is a particularly harrowing case where this airplane was descending into what looked like haze, and a volcanic plume from the Redoubt volcano, and this was December 1989, December 15th to be exact, and the pilot, actually it was a female pilot, it was the only female captain that KLM had at the time. She had a wonderful flying job, wonderful piloting job. She descended into what looked like a haze layer and then got smell of sulfur in the cockpit and then realized that her engines were failing, and I'll tell you why they failed in a second, but basically four engines flamed out, And she lost power, and the plane started to descend. And they frantically tried to restart the engines, and they had multiple engine restarts. I think they tried seven times unsuccessfully, falling from 25,000 feet down to about 12,500, where they leveled the plane out. They got one engine relit, and then the other three came online, and they got the engines restarted. And they leveled out at about 12,000 feet after about a minute and a half. And they had fallen quite a distance and leveled out just above the mountains. And they were about 500 feet above the terrain, which was at 12,000 feet at that point. So it was a very, very close call. Now, what happened to what made the engine stop? Well, ash is very finely ground up rock. It's very abrasive, so you get abrasion in the engine. That's not good. Now, on top of that, what happens is the ash will melt on the turbine blades. Turbine blades can operate up to their own, practically at their own melting temperature, if not above. So these blades are coated with special coatings and also are drilled with holes. And the ash will come in and flash melt on the blade, and then get cooled by the cooling air and then solidified, so you get a ceramic glaze on the blade. You also erode the thermal coatings, which doesn't help. But now the blade can't cool itself. It's a pervasive problem, and that's the big deal. The injection of the ash up into the atmosphere and the capturing the ash by the global wind circulation system, that projects the ash in such a way that now it's the flying public is very vulnerable. And so we're trying hard to figure out ways to detect it, to track it, predict where it's going to go, and also to mitigate the effect to the airplanes.
You've been listening to David Pieri, staff research scientist in the science division of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He uses an instrument called ASTER for Advanced Spaceborne Thermal Emission and Reflection Radiometer on NASA's Terra satellite. Our thanks today to the Terra mission, helping us better understand and protect our home planet. I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
In Oxford in the 1950s, there was a fantastic doctor who was very unusual, named Alice Stewart. And Alice was unusual partly because, of course, she was a woman, which was pretty rare in the 1950s. And she was brilliant. She was one of the, at the time, the youngest fellow to be elected to the Royal College of Physicians. She was unusual, too, because she continued to work after she got married, after she had kids. And even after she got divorced and was a single parent, she continued her medical work. And she was unusual because she was really interested in a new science, the emerging field of epidemiology, the study of patterns in disease. But like every scientist, she appreciated that to make her mark, what she needed to do was find a hard problem and solve it. The hard problem that Alice chose was the rising incidence of childhood cancers. Most disease is correlated with poverty, but in the case of childhood cancers, the children who were dying seemed mostly to come from affluent families. So what, she wanted to know, could explain this anomaly? Now, Alice had trouble getting funding for her research. In the end, she got just £1,000 from the Lady Tata Memorial Prize, and that meant she knew she only had one shot at collecting her data. Now, she had no idea what to look for. This really was a needle in a haystack sort of search. So she asked everything she could think of. Had the children eaten boiled sweets? Had they consumed colored drinks? Did they eat fish and chips? Did they have indoor or outdoor plumbing? What time of life had they started school? And when her carbon-copied questionnaire started to come back, one thing and one thing only jumped out with a statistical clarity of a kind that most scientists can only dream of. By a rate of 2 to 1, the children who had died had had mothers who had been x-rayed when pregnant. Now, that finding flew in the face of conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom held that everything was safe up to a point, a threshold. It flew in the face of conventional wisdom, which was huge enthusiasm for the cool new technology of that age, which was the X-ray machine. And it flew in the face of doctors' idea of themselves, which was as people who helped patients, they didn't harm them. Nevertheless, Alice Stewart rushed to publish her preliminary findings in The Lancet in 1956. People got very excited. There was talk of the Nobel Prize. And Alice really was in a big hurry to try to study all the cases of childhood cancer she could find before they disappeared. In fact, she need not have hurried. It was fully 25 years before the British and American medical establishments abandoned the practice of X-raying pregnant women. The data was out there, it was open, it was freely available, but nobody wanted to know. A child a week was dying, but nothing changed. Openness alone can't drive change. So for 25 years, Alice Stewart had a very big fight on her hands. So how did she know that she was right? Well, she had a fantastic model for thinking. She worked with a statistician named George Neal, and George was pretty much everything that Alice wasn't. So Alice was very outgoing and sociable, and George was a recluse. Alice was very warm, very empathetic with her patients. George frankly preferred numbers to people. But he said this fantastic thing about their working relationship. He said, "My job is to prove Dr. Stewart wrong." He actively sought disconfirmation, different ways of looking at her models, at her statistics, different ways of crunching the data in order to disprove her. He saw his job as creating conflict around her theories, because it was only by not being able to prove that she was wrong that George could give Alice the confidence she needed to know that she was right. It's a fantastic model of collaboration. Thinking partners who aren't echo chambers. I wonder how many of us have or dare to have such collaborators. Alice and George were very good at conflict. They saw it as thinking. So what does that kind of constructive conflict require? Well, first of all, it requires that we find people who are very different from ourselves. That means we have to resist the neurobiological drive, which means that we really prefer people mostly like ourselves. And it means we have to seek out people with different backgrounds, different disciplines, different ways of thinking, and different experience, and find ways to engage with them. That requires a lot of patience and a lot of energy. And the more I've thought about this, the more I think, really, that that's a kind of love, because you simply won't commit that kind of energy and time if you don't really care. And it also means that we have to be prepared to change our minds. Alice's daughter told me that every time Alice went head-to-head with a fellow scientist, they made her think and think and think again. My mother, she said, my mother didn't enjoy a fight, but she was really good at them. So it's one thing to do that in a one-to-one relationship, but it strikes me that the biggest problems we face, many of the biggest disasters that we've experienced, mostly haven't come from individuals, they've come from organizations, some of them bigger than countries, many of them capable of affecting hundreds, thousands, even millions of lives. So how do organizations think? Well, for the most part, they don't. And that isn't because they don't want to. It's really because they can't. And they can't because the people inside of them are too afraid of conflict. In surveys of European and American executives, fully 85% of them acknowledged that they had issues or concerns at work that they were afraid to raise. Afraid of the conflict that that would provoke, afraid to get embroiled in arguments that they did not know how to manage and felt that they were bound to lose. 85% is a really big number. It means that organizations mostly can't do what George and Alice so triumphantly did. They can't think together. And it means that people like many of us who have run organizations and gone out of our way to try to find the very best people we can mostly fail to get the best out of them. So how do we develop the skills that we need? Because it does take skill and practice, too. If we aren't going to be afraid of conflict, we have to see it as thinking, and then we have to get really good at it. So recently, I worked with an executive named Joe, and Joe worked for a medical device company. And Joe was very worried about the device that he was working on. He thought that it was too complicated, and he thought that its complexity created margins of error that could really hurt people. He was afraid of doing damage to the patients he was trying to help. But when he looked around his organization, nobody else seemed to be at all worried. So he didn't really want to say anything. After all, maybe they knew something he didn't. Maybe he'd looked stupid. But he kept worrying about it. And he worried about it so much that he got to the point where he thought the only thing he could do was leave a job he loved. In the end, Joe and I found a way for him to raise his concerns. And what happened then is what almost always happens in this situation. It turned out everybody had exactly the same questions and doubts. So now Joe had allies. They could think together. Candidates are willing and able to stand up to authority. I think it's a fantastic system, but I think leaving it to PhD candidates is far too few people and way too late in life. I think we need to be teaching these skills to kids and adults at every stage of their development if we want to have thinking organizations and a thinking society. The fact is that most of the biggest catastrophes that we've witnessed rarely come from information that is secret or hidden. It comes from information that is freely available and out there, but that we are willfully blind to because we can't handle, don't want to handle, the conflict that it provokes. But when we dare to break that silence, or when we dare to see, and we create conflict, we enable ourselves and the people around us to do our very best thinking. Open information is fantastic. Use it.
Excuse me. Hi. My grandfather lived in this village.
Mio nonno viveva in questo villaggio.
And here, everyone speaks the same language. In here, cars call mechanics before you do.
Pass me the
in here, doctors see you before you get to the hospital.
No, we didn't pass it. Yeah, we're looking at that.
In here, friends leave you messages written in the air.
What's the word there?
It's the AT&T network. A network of possibilities. And what's possible in here is almost impossible to say. AT&T.
WHFR, Dearborn.
Fall registration for Henry Ford Community College is underway, with a wide variety of programs and degree options to choose from. Let HFCC guide you on your way to higher education. For more information, contact the Office of Registration and Records by calling 313-845-6403 or online at hfcc.edu.
Once again, the Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market returns to bring in support of local farmers and entrepreneurs right to the heart of Dearborn. Beginning May the 25th, over 30 Michigan vendors will be selling some of the finest seasonal products, from produce goods and flowers to garden art and woodworkings. This will also mark additional times for the market. Tuesday evenings, June 19th, July 17th, and August the 21st. The Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market will be open every Friday starting May the 25th from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m.